we're commanded to serve our families and our communities to the best of our abilities. And, you know, we should take our vocational responsibilities in these areas very seriously. And I think that involves making sure that we create conditions in America that continue to allow religious freedom and allow our Lutheran faith to continue to thrive, and that we can continue to evangelize.
Mark Hemingway talking about his joint presentation with his wife Molly at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
The fact of the matter is that on those particular issues of religious liberty and preserving our faith from the onslaught of bad cultural and political ideas, things have never been more dire, and it's more important than ever.
You can meet and hear journalists Mark and Molly Hemingway making the case for Christian political engagement at the 2020 Issues Etc. Making the Case conference. The premier conference for Christian laity is Friday, June 12th and Saturday, June 13th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org.
When we began this race for the presidency, everybody said it couldn't be done. But tonight, I tell you with absolute confidence, we are going to win the Democratic nomination. And we are going to defeat the most dangerous president in the history of this country.
It's time for America to get back up. And once again, fight for the proposition that we hold these truths to be self-evident. That all men and women are created equal, endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights. We've never lived up to those words, but until this president, we've never walked away from it.
We are better than this moment. We are better than this president.
So get back up and take back this country.
Democratic presidential candidates Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden speaking last night post Super Tuesday. It was a surprise for many. What in the world does it mean? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Wednesday afternoon, March the 4th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk about the Super Tuesday election analysis. Mark Hemingway, senior writer for Real Clear Investigations, will be our guest first off. Terry Mattingly joins us after that. We'll talk about media coverage of the coronavirus and pastoral practice. Then Pastor Will Whedon joins us in our series on the words of Scripture continues. Today, the word is peace. He's host of the daily short-form Bible study produced by Lutheran Public Radio called The Word of the Lord Endures Forever. Joining us to do a little Super Tuesday election analysis, Mark Hemingway, senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. Mark, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Glad to be back.
Why are most pundits surprised by Vice President Biden's Super Tuesday performance?
Well, I mean, it happened so quickly. I mean, remember, Biden made an abysmal showing in the first two primaries in Iowa and New Hampshire, which usually set the tone. He came roaring back in winning the South Carolina primary, sort of reinforcing his sort of long-held connection with black voters because of his partnership with Barack Obama. And within, you know, like 72 hours after that, we have Super Tuesday, where something like 30% of all the delegates in the Democratic primary are allocated, and Biden came in with, you know, major momentum as a result of a South Carolina win, and a couple of other moderate candidates like Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg dropping out and throwing their support to him. So it was quite the turnaround and quite a short amount of time. The big question, however, is whether or not this is because voters are genuinely enthusiastic about Biden. I don't think that's the case. I think it's more that a lot of Democratic voters in the Democratic establishment quickly realized that Bernie Sanders running around praising communists and being the standard bearer for their party could be disastrous if they let him be the nominee.
Former Democratic National Committee Chairwoman Donna Brazile called Biden's comeback, quote, the most impressive 72 hours I've seen in U.S. politics. What's your reaction?
I mean, I would say it was impressive in terms of the shift in momentum. I mean, you know, a week or two ago, it looked like Bernie Sanders was going to be somewhat indomitable going ahead in the race based on national polls and everything else. I mean, is it impressive because Joe Biden himself, as the candidate, did anything? Like I said, I'm not honestly sure. I mean, I think it was more just the collective realization of the Democratic establishment and voters realizing that, you know, they had to stand up and oppose Bernie Sanders, partly because there might be disastrous down ballot consequences and lasting damage to the party going forward. And so, yeah, I mean, it was certainly impressive. I just don't know if it to the extent it's impressive, it's necessarily something that bodes well for November in that, you know, we have to establish whether or not Joe Biden is a good candidate and people are enthusiastic about voting for him. And thus far, I don't think we can say that.
Mayor Mike Bloomberg announced earlier today that he is suspending his campaign. What effect will this have?
Well, I don't really know. I mean, he barely got any votes on Super Tuesday. I think he got one delegate from American Samoa or something like that, or a couple of delegates from American Samoa. I don't know if he has that much support in terms of, you know, people voting for him that is going to shift to Biden. But him getting out of the race, and if he stops spending hundreds of millions of dollars on his own vanity campaign and starts pouring that money into Biden's race, you know, certainly that can have an impact. But if, you know, at the same time, you know, if there's anything we've learned in the past few election cycles, it's that money isn't nearly as big an advantage as people have made it out to be. Trump was outspent 2-1 in 2016 and still won the election.
And comparing Biden's lack of funds, at least going into last night's elections, and as contrasted with Bloomberg's bottomless pit of money, it does kind of throw the conventional wisdom that money makes a big difference at least a little off kilter, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, money can't be the sole deciding factor. You know, Bloomberg was a disastrous candidate in a lot of ways. And even though he'd been elected in New York twice, you know, and that's not nothing, he couldn't use that money to translate it to a his whatever modest political success he'd had thus far, couldn't use money alone to translate to a national political audience. It turns out that you actually have to have, in the case of Bloomberg, who initially ran as a Republican and then ran as an independent, you have to have some sort of credibility with Democratic voters. And further, you can't also try and use money to whitewash a troubling history of a sexist comments and, you know, all sorts of other horrifying things that Bloomberg had done over the years.
Why is Senator Elizabeth Warren staying in the race?
That's a good question. It's possible she's staying in the race, at least for now, because she is trying to extract some sort of guarantee from one of the other candidates. There's a lot of speculation that she, well, at least there has been this afternoon anyway, that she's going to, you know, endorse Sanders. If she does that, it might be because she is, you know, angling for a VP slot. And if not, she might be trying to negotiate something, you know, from Biden. Maybe she wants to be Treasury Secretary or something like that. It's very hard to say. And the other possibility I would just throw out there is that no candidate in this race, at least, you know, until the last month or two, has had more fawning over her by the press. And so, you know, it's always possible the candidate gets gone to her head a bit and she can't quite see the reality heading forward that, you know, she doesn't really have a path to the nomination.
What does a Warren exit, who does that benefit most?
It's hard to say because she has kind of an interesting appeal. On one hand, she appeals to a lot of suburban moms and women voters. On the other hand, she's clearly the other progressive in the race, and certainly her supporters, you know, might be inclined to move toward Sanders if she's out of the race. You know, a lot of people were attracted to her because she seemed to put, you know, more of a democratic and technocratic pedigree on top of some of the more radical progressive ideas that Bernie has. I mean, and Bernie's just unabashedly running crazy left. He's not even bothering to explain how he's going to pay for Medicare for All and things like that. And Elizabeth Warren at least tried to square the circle a little bit in terms of financing for some of these progressive initiatives and you know, and be a more substantive progressive candidate in that regard. So, I don't know, it's hard to say. My inclination is to say that it probably benefits Bernie a little bit more than it does Biden, but it's hard to say. It's not like she got a lot of votes yesterday. Clearly, the Democratic electorate has decided that this is a two-man race.
Compare and contrast the delegate totals for the Democratic presidential race today to the post-Super Tuesday in 2016.
Well, right now, Biden has about a little less than 40 delegates more than Sanders. I think Biden has about 250 or so, 252. Sanders has 215 delegates. Coming out of Super Tuesday in 2016, Trump had a slightly larger lead over his nearest competitor, Ted Cruz. I think he had like 280 delegates to 100 and, you know, 90-some for Cruz. So it's actually a tighter race at this point in time, but the perception thus far is that because Biden had so much momentum and all of a sudden he's starting to top national polls again after Sanders had been topping them for a while, that somehow going forward that Biden will clean up, you know, in the delegate count. And that might be right. It's very true that it might. On the other hand, you know, it's awfully close in terms of delegate counts. And if we head up a situation here where there's always the possibility, especially with Sanders being 78 years old and Joe Biden being 77 and not sounding too great on the stump, and Sanders having had a heart attack a few months ago, that, you know, something could happen tomorrow that could fundamentally change the dynamics of the race, be it a health problem, you know, an incredibly embarrassing gaffe by Joe Biden, of which he seems to be making more and more of, something like that that could really just sort of shake voters' faith in either candidate and can completely change the dynamics of the race, especially considering it's so close. And there are, you know, plenty of scenarios that we've been gaming out for a long time now where the delegate count is so close, we go into the Democratic convention where there has to be some sort of, you know, deal-making, superdelegates come into play, or all these other sort of institutional forces end up putting their thumb on the scale for one candidate or the other. And that, you know, could have a lot of really negative effects on the Democratic Party. And the other thing Democrats are just frankly contending with is that, you know, Sanders' support is sort of very uniquely left-wing and very uniquely his. If they do too much to alienate him or Biden blows him out of the race, it's possible that he'll have a chunk of supporters that just won't show up at the polls in November because they're frustrated and want the Democratic Party to take a more overtly left-leaning direction.
Do you think it's possible that he would attempt a run as an independent?
I mean, anything's possible. I mean, I doubt it, but I don't know. Sanders is a little sort of crazy in good and bad ways. On one hand, I suppose it's admirable that he is very, very committed to his principles. I mean, I think that he's correctly even diagnosed some things in terms of, you know, voter disenchantment at the grassroots level that the Democratic Party has sort of institutionally ignored. It's just that I find that his policy solutions are so crazy and left-wing and out of step with the majority of people in this country that it kind of overshadows the fact that he does have kind of a unique bond with, you know, a certain sort of working class voter in terms of how he perceives and understands their struggles. So, I don't know. It's just hard to say.
Mark Hemingway is our guest. He's senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. We're doing some Super Tuesday election analysis. We'll talk about those superdelegates that he mentioned a moment ago after the break.
Since 1978, Lutheran Church Extension Fund has had the humble privilege of supporting Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Ministries and her workers. Thanks to faithful investors, LCEF has provided thousands of church workers, congregations, schools, and organizations with the low-cost loans and resources they need to reach more people with the saving name of Christ. To learn more, visit lcef.org or call 800-843-5233, 800-843-5233.
Your sun-bleached felt church banners have seen better days. Held together with staples and superglue, they are a monument to Aunt Mabel's pastel-toned creativity from 1960. But it's time for a refresh. Ad Crucem has the solution that doesn't even need a Sharpie. We proudly offer Scapegoat Studios creations as well as Ad Crucem's original banners. Come and browse our wide selection of seasonal church banners. We also create banners and church signs to your design. Visit adcrucem.com. That's ADCRUCEM.com.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
In 1939, the British Army received an Enigma machine that helped them crack the secret Nazi codes in World War II. In the March issue of the Lutheran Witness, the Reverend Sam Schultheitz writes about the Screwtape Letters, a book written by C.S. Lewis, a type of Enigma machine for deciphering the temptations of Satan. Read the March issue of the Lutheran Witness to learn more about the Screwtape Letters and how Satan tempts us today. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective. cph.org/witness.
Would you like to help a college or seminary student attend the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference? You can purchase a conference scholarship for a contribution of $135 to Issues Etc. You can donate online at issuesetc.org/scholarship, or you can make a $135 check payable to Issues Etc., write scholarship in the memo line, and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234.
¶¶
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're doing some Super Tuesday election analysis. Mark Hemingway of Real Clear Investigations is our guest. Mark, a moment ago you had mentioned the Democratic superdelegates. Can you explain that system to a political novice? How does it work?
So in the Democratic Party, you know, in the primary, you're awarded delegates based on, you know, the primaries and caucuses you win in the primary races. But in addition to that, there is a layer of what they call superdelegates, where they apportion a vote to various party insiders, ex-politicians, party functionaries, that sort of thing, so that, you know, they get a vote in terms of deciding who the nominee is. Now, usually the race clears out in such a way that there's a clear front runner and, you know, superdelegate votes don't really come into play or just end up rubber stamping the will of the voters. But we saw in 2016 a lot of, I forget exactly how the superdelegates came into play in 2016, but there was certainly a lot of talk about using them. The Democratic Party in 2016 was basically just, you know, an extension of the Clinton campaign, regardless of whether or not Bernie was mounting a legitimate challenge or not. And, well, the Sanders people had a lot of very legitimate complaints about how the process itself was used against them, and the Democratic Party, which was supposed to be a neutral arbiter, was in fact, you know, putting their thumb on the scale for Hillary Clinton. And I think there's the fear that this will happen again. Certainly it was so bad that Sanders was able to get a lot of changes to the process this time around, you know, lest the Democratic Party anger a component of voters, a significant component of the electorate that they didn't want to anger by having these, you know, undemocratic votes, you know, weigh in the form of superdelegates and decide who the nominee is.
Vice President Biden won 58% of the African-American vote last night. How do you explain Biden's appeal and Senator Sanders' lack of appeal with Black Americans?
Well, Biden's appeal is just pretty much the fact that he was Barack Obama's, you know, vice president. I mean, he supported him to the hilt all 8 years, and that alone, I think, established a lot of trust with Black voters, and that is, you know, certainly understandable. And, you know, he's just been around for a long time in Democratic politics, and, you know, he's made a lot of sort of, you know, friendly contacts with African-American Democrats, I think, over that time. You know, certainly he's known James Clyburn, who was kind of the kingmaker in the South Carolina primary that, you know, got his campaign back on track, you know, a few days ago. So, I mean, I think it's just, you know, the fundamental sort of trust from being, you know, close to Barack Obama and his relationships forged with Black politicians over the years. You know, Black voters know who he is and essentially trust him more so than they do other Democrats. As for Sanders, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, part of it is just that culturally, Bernie Sanders is a Brooklyn-born Jewish man from Vermont. I mean, that is not a cultural milieu that incorporates a lot of sort of African Americans and an understanding necessarily of the African American experience, at least in cultural terms, in the way Bernie Sanders comes off. Now, Bernie Sanders, I think, did do some things involved in the civil rights struggle and stuff when he was younger, and that you know, maybe will count for something. I just don't think that he's done a very good job of sort of pitching himself to African American voters. After he lost the South Carolina primary, Sanders put out an ad where he is, you know, like walking with Barack Obama and talking about Barack Obama praising him for some of the things that he'd done. So clearly Sanders has finally realized that this is sort of a big weakness. And further, just the sort of liberal progressive movement in this country is not something that is, as of yet, really appeals to African Americans. African Americans tend to be far and away the most socially conservative Democratic voters. And they, for a lot of weird historical and legacy reasons, are with the Democratic Party now, and are with the Democratic Party certainly because of Obama, but they're a bad fit in the Democratic coalition in terms of a lot of the things they actually believe. So they're much more inclined to go with a moderate candidate, I think, in certain ways, than they are with someone who is, you know, liberal and progressive.
Why is Senator Sanders' biggest minority Black Latino voters?
I don't really know how to explain that. It's a good question. I think that there actually is a strain of sort of liberal progressivism within the Latino political community that I don't quite think is as prevalent in the African-American voting bloc. You know, if you're familiar with groups like the Raza and things like that, I mean, there's much more sort of overt left-wing politics among Hispanic-American, at least political circles. And that, you know, certainly reflects Mexican, Central American, and South American influences in this country. You know, but certainly the Hispanic populations have had more, you know, contact with sort of, you know, left-wing progressivism than the African-American community in terms of, you know, if you go back to a lot of the countries where these people have immigrated from. So I don't know. I mean, I think maybe that explains part of it. But I think the other thing is that that is in an area where the Sanders campaign, which has basically been operating in full effect since 2016, never really stopped campaigning. There were a lot of organizers on the ground and things like that that made a lot of sort of successful and overt efforts to reach out to those communities and bring them on board. And I think we're seeing a little bit of the fruits of that.
Do the primaries coming up favor Biden or Sanders?
That is a good question. I mean, I think it's hard to say because all this stuff, you know, sort of breaks down, you know, state by state. I mean, I think in general, the momentum is sort of shifted. And if you look at sort of the exit polls in terms of, you break it out in terms of demographics, in terms of who the average Democratic voter is and things like that, the whole general climate sort of, I think, favors Biden a little. There were also some things where the exit polls, you know, that should be pretty worrisome for Sanders yesterday, which is the exit polls showed that, you know, just not that significant a percentage of voters in the Democratic primary were, you know, say voters, you know, 29 and under, which, you know, there's been a lot made of the supposed enthusiasm that Sanders gets from younger voters. And if he can't actually translate that into votes at the polls, then that bodes very poorly for him. You know, I mean, I'd say if you were a betting man, the odds favor Biden. But like I said, there are so many things right now with a 77 and 78-year-old candidate and the race very much in flux where, you know, the dynamic of this race could change in a heartbeat.
Democratic primary voters showed up in record numbers Tuesday in Utah and Virginia. They exceeded their 2016 turnout levels in several other states. What does that mean?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, it's a very close sort of, you know, contested election. You know, we've seen pretty high turnout in the Republican primary this year, and there's really no one running other than Trump. So I think it just reflects an overall level of political engagement in this country right now. I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing. I mean, when things are bad and people feel anxiety, you know, they tend to be much more interested in politics than when things are going well. But, you know, based on what we've seen thus far, you know, it could mean that there's, you know, a tremendous enthusiasm for people from Democrats who want to vote in November, or it could simply mean that they view this was sort of an important inflection point that, you know, they couldn't let Bernie Sanders define the party, and so all of a sudden there was a big surge toward Biden voters.
Which candidate does President Trump's reelection team fear the most?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, you have to sit. I think Biden is probably the candidate they want to run against less, although I don't think that they're necessarily worried about running against Biden. But, you know, certainly Sanders, you know, we pointed out his weaknesses in terms of, you know, lack of enthusiasm from African Americans, which is a very important part of the Democratic coalition in terms of winning national elections. And just in general, there was so much opposition research. I mean, there are like, you could just roll out 20, 30-minute, you know, long clips of Sanders praising different communist regimes one after the other. And, you know, then, of course, there was a lot of, despite the appeal among a certain segment of people, there was a lot of sort of, you know, weaknesses to his sort of policy approach. A lot of it just seemed to be pie in the sky, and it wasn't very workable from a practical perspective. So, I mean, I think they were probably looking probably more hopeful toward hopeful about the prospect of running against Sanders. On the other hand, what we've seen of Joe Biden, you know, who looks like Joe Biden looks like the strongest candidate in paper. We can all agree he's a known quantity. He's been around. African American voters like him. You know, there are some other things like that. But in general, people have been watching him out on the stump, you know, everyone that's seen him in person. I mean, his rallies thus far and everything have been pretty uninspiring. He's clearly showing his advanced age. I just watched a clip of him from 2016, and it sure seems like the mental degradation in just the last 4 years is stark. And there, you know, at his acceptance speech last night, he confused his wife and his sister. He was praised by journalists, whatever, for being more disciplined in post-South Carolina, which meant finishing sentences. So there are all kinds of problems with Joe Biden in terms of him being a really weak and uninspiring candidate. I don't think a lot of Democrats view him as anything other than, you know, sort of a consensus pick that they can get behind. And on top of that, Biden has been around forever. I mean, Trump ran as an outsider. You know, Biden was a senator for 36 years plus the 8 years he spent in the White House. I mean, crazily enough, it makes it possible for an existing president of the United States to still run as an outsider against him. And on top of that, Biden's record is really sort of, you know, dubious. He is probably the guy that is single-handedly responsible for destroying the judicial nominations process in this country and turning it into this pitched battle where, you know, people fling ugly accusations. I mean, that's pretty much all Biden's fault, you know, when he ran the Judiciary Committee in the 80s and 90s when, you know, he was responsible for the destruction of Robert Bork's nomination and very nearly did a torpedoed Clarence Thomas's nomination to the Supreme Court with ugly accusations. He passed, I think, one piece of legislation that was largely struck down by the Supreme Court in his 36 years in the Senate. And then there's all the Obama baggage that you could hit him with, you know, suing nuns, their failed Iran deal. I mean, all kinds of things that you could go after Biden on because he's just been around forever and he doesn't have a good record to boot.
Mark Hemingway and his wife Molly will be responding to attendees' questions and comments at the 2020 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. The premier conference for Christian laity is Friday, June 12th and Saturday, June 13th at Concordia University, Chicago. Attendance is limited to 500, and Making the Case is 98% full. Thanks to Lutheran Church Extension Fund sponsorship, child care is free for children ages 1 through 12. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. Mark Hemingway is senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Terry Mattingly is with us on the other side of the break. We're going to spend some time talking about the coronavirus and the pastoral office, the practices, the contacts that pastors make, as well as that common cup, the chalice, and its media coverage. Stay tuned.
See My Savior's Hands. The title says it all.
Pastor Will Whedon, author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, See My Savior's Hands.
In pictures and words, we follow Jesus' story by watching his hands, from childhood to his baptism, from his healings and miracles all the way to the cross, from his resurrection to his ascension. We'll see that his hands are always active at work to bring us blessing.
Learn more and purchase See My Savior's Hands, a book for children ages 4 through 7 at issuesetc.org.
This is Pastor Clint Poppy, Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Lincoln, Nebraska, a proud supporter of Issues Etc. Each month we host the Nebraska Lutherans for Confessional Study, a serious study of Lutheran theology. We generally meet on the fourth Thursday of each month from 9:30 to 2:30, and both clergy and laity are invited. There is no charge to attend. For more information, please call the church office or visit our website, goodshepherdlincoln.org, and click on the green NLCS tab.
It is the greatest adventure you could ever possibly imagine. It's demanding, it's hard, it's challenging, and what a blessing it is.
Dr. Larry Rast, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why a man should consider the vocation of pastor.
And it is an incredible blessing to be honored with the opportunity to work with these incredible young men and older men as well, who are committing themselves to the proclamation of God's word, the right distinction of law and gospel, and to take the good news of Jesus Christ into all the world.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all.
We're supported by listeners like you. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Concordia University Chicago is a distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We're committed to increasing LCMS faculty and staff members. Hi, this is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia University Chicago. If you're a member of our Lutheran Church Missouri Synod congregation, please consider joining our staff. And if you have a terminal degree, please consider joining our faculty. Send us an email at human.resources@cuchicago.edu.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod celebrates and affirms life from the time of conception until natural death and every time in between. For this reason, LCMS Life Ministry is a program singularly devoted to upholding the sanctity of human life, both in our church body and the culture at large. Life Ministry provides educational materials, hosts conferences, and works closely with allies such as Lutherans for Life. For more information, visit lcms.org/life and follow LCMS Life Ministry on Facebook.